Sports Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Let's begin today's reading with a feature entitled Lindsey Vonn. 5 years after retiring from competition, the 40-year-old skiing stalwart has made a rapid, pain-free comeback with one clear goal in mind: to race at the 2026 Winter Olympics. And this Sports Illustrated feature is written by Greg Bishop. Yes, Lindsey Vonn understands the landscape. Tom Brady, Simone Biles, Novak Djokovic, quote, and LeBron, she says in early January, shortly after her unprecedented comeback at age 40, is only a few months younger than I am, and he's still breaking records every game he plays, pretty much so, unquote. Yes, Lindsey Vonn heard from all of you that she's gone completely mad, as one retired skier so sensitively put it, that she's craving attention, that she should have stayed retired. Last summer, Vonn went to Paris, where Biles, age 27, was the oldest U.S. gymnast to compete at the Olympics since the year 1952. Vonn watched Biles, she says, quote, far exceed what everyone believed to be the limits of a gymnast's physical ability to perform in her third games, unquote. Sports Illustrated asked Lindsey Vonn, they called Simone Grandma. Lindsey Vonn replies, nobody said that to me yet, or at least not to my face. Sports Illustrated next asks, Brady told me 10 years ago that older elite athletes are examined with old paradigms. Do you agree? Lindsey Vonn replies, totally. You cannot compare athletes now to even 10 years ago because of what's available. There's so much more that we understand and know about the body and performance. Age is not an indication these days of whether an athlete can be successful or not. The biggest question is, do they have the skill? Do they have the knowledge? Brady was the smartest quarterback in history. That knowledge has value, and in ski racing, it's similar. I have been racing for a lot longer than a lot of my competitors have been alive. I have a lot more knowledge, and that is meaningful. I have the ability to put those things together and do exactly what Tom did, unquote. Vonn never planned this comeback. It just sort of happened. The basics, injuries accumulated until she could no longer compete. She worked on her body, stayed in shape, and had access to all sorts of elite doctors, had conversations with them, and listened to them. Then met one who was different than the others, and that changed the only opinion that mattered, hers. Sports Illustrated's next question, patience seems critical to hear. Not the first thing I'd associate with ski racing, but it is necessary, no? Lindsey Vonn replies, We are the epitome of an outside, outdoor sport. We have to be patient with the weather and the schedule. It's a game of hurry up and wait. You have to be patient right up until that moment, which requires aggression, balance, calmness, and a strong mind. Unquote. To understand how the impossible became quite possible, allow Vaughn to explain, quote, I dream big. I've always dreamed big. I've been about the Olympics since I met Picabo Street when I was 9 years old. I have lots of dreams, and I'm still dreaming pretty high. That part of me has not changed, and I don't think it ever will, so you can imagine what I am thinking about, unquote. You seem free now, is that fair to say? Lindsey Vaughn replies, I mean, sometimes people's perception of me changed. My perception of myself never has. I'm still the same little girl who wanted to be a ski racer and wanted to be an Olympian. Maybe now I'm just a little bit more myself. I don't have the expectations or outside pressure I might have felt more before. People see this in my face. I'm having such a great time. I'm laughing, I'm smiling, and some of that is a weight that has been lifted off of me. I feel like a kid, and that may sound weird coming from a 40-year-old, but sometimes you just never grow up. Maybe that means I'm naive, but I can still dream. Unquote. Vaughn retired only when her dreams felt unreachable, her body broken, ligaments torn, in daily pain. She left competitive ski racing in 2019 after 15 seasons with 82 World Cup wins, at the time the most ever for a female competitor, a mark that has since been broken by Michaela Schifrin, who has 99 now, and second most ever behind the pre-Schifrin gold standard, 86 victories by Ingemar Stenmark. Vaughn also claimed 3 Olympic medals, 20 World Cup titles, including 4 Crystal Globes for overall performance, 8 World Championship medals, and 137 World Cup podiums. But she also tore her ACL and MCL in her right knee in a 2013 crash, and then re-injured that same ACL later that year. In 2018, she tore her LCL in her left knee and had multiple fractures in that same leg during a training crash. And that's not counting another knee fracture, ankle fracture, and severe arm fracture in between those tears. She dove into retirement by taking off the bubble wrap that elite skiers must don to survive a dangerous sport. She windsurfed and surfed wakes. She tried polo, but that didn't work out. She injured her back after a bad fall from one horse, got healthy, and climbed right back on. She took adventures and traveled the world. And she skied recreationally, traveling to slopes that she had never raced on, taking leisurely runs, not knowing what she might do on a particular afternoon. She entertained tons of business opportunities and continued her work empowering and supporting underserved young women in competitive skiing. She also helped bring the Winter Games to Salt Lake City in 2034. Quote, just being as injured as I've been, I have had to wise up and figure out what my body can and cannot do and what my injuries mean, what it looks like, what it feels like. I have to understand my anatomy better than anyone else, and that's been the case since my first ACL tear in 2013, because I had problems that I didn't quite understand until later, unquote. She leaned on specialists and other doctors that they recommended. Dr. Tom Hackett, a complex knee and shoulder surgeon based in Colorado, recommended Dr. Martin Roche, perhaps the foremost international expert on robotic and sensor-assisted surgery, who is based in Florida. Quote, "Doctors have different opinions. It was important for me to research and take them all in. My body, technically, if you read an MRI, says I need a full knee replacement because it's done," unquote. Every doctor that Vaughn saw recommended a total knee replacement, except one, Dr. Roche. Quote, "He had a different perspective, and he was very smart about it. Because of him, we found that I had a cyst in my bone from one of my ACL surgeries, and I couldn't even get the replacements because I needed to clean out the cyst and refill and repack the bone," unquote. Vaughn also spoke with others who had undergone this specific surgery, like Chris Davenport, an extreme skier who saw Roche and now skis nearly half the year. Hackett performed the cyst cleanup for Vaughn in July of 2023. Roche did the partial replacement, what is known as robot-assisted replacement, by cutting off 3 millimeters of bone and replacing that with 2 titanium pieces. Quote, "I had only hoped to live life pain-free. The procedure changed my life entirely. I used to think about my knee pretty much every second of every day, wake up sore and swollen. I would go on a hike with my friend and her 7-year-old, and Aunt Lindsay would need a break after 10 minutes. It was really hard, and I thought when I retired, giving my body a break would take away a lot of pain, and it didn't," unquote. 1 month after the second surgery, Vaughn could straighten that troublesome right leg. Once back in the gym, she tried exercises that she had long ago shelved, too painful, and sometimes her body felt like it was 8 years younger, other times even younger than that. Once back on the slopes, she was knocking out 9 training runs at first, then 15 in a single day. She hadn't done that since her mid-20s. She knew she wanted to come back, regardless of history, after that very first training run. Quote, "Everything felt so different. When I got the surgery, I just felt so good. No more pain. All the things that had been bothering me for so many years were suddenly gone," unquote. Comeback became her mission. At the highest levels of her sport, too. Finally able to train without her knee swelling, she could dream again. Vaughn enrolled in the drug testing program for World Cup competitors last September and was promptly tested the next day, and quite frequently since. She shifted back into her old life as quietly as possible, but not quietly enough. News spread slowly, informally at first, within the insular world that she had left behind. She was coming back as the bionic woman. Quote, "I do feel bionic. I was saying that even before my knee replacement, because I have a plate and 18 screws in my arm, which gives me a pretty good volleyball serve. I've been put together more times than I'd care to count or admit. If titanium will heal me, I'll be the Terminator anytime," unquote. Ahead of her 40th birthday in October, Vaughn canceled a trip to a tropical destination that she had planned roughly 6 months earlier. Instead, she found herself training in Austria. Quote, I didn't expect to be there. I needed to do something special for my 40th. We went to this cute hotel on Lake Como, had a nice dinner, a little cake, and that's it, unquote. Vaughn's thinking had changed after the partial replacement. Sure, she needed to adjust to new equipment and ramp back slowly towards her own standard. She completed the required doping tests and re-entered World Cup qualifying. Rejoined the U.S. team, mentoring skiers whose median age is 26. Took part in lower-level competitions at Copper Mountain in Colorado. Qualified with a wild card. Served as the forerunner, skiing ahead of the field to test the course and timing system in nearby Beaver Creek. And earned enough points to compete on the World Cup circuit. Flew to Switzerland in December. Competed in her first World Cup race since failing to finish a Super G race in January of 2019 in Italy. Had butterflies before competing, first time, long time. Raced first at about 85%, upped that to 90% for her second spin down a mountain at full speed. Quote, I have trained with top 30, top 20, even top 10 competitors for the last few weeks. Some days I'm winning training. Some days I'm testing out equipment. There's some rust to shake off, but I really haven't lost anything. I feel like I'm right where I left off, and I'm actually healthier now than I was for the last few years, unquote. In terms of acclimation, Vaughn stuck around Europe, continued training, and competed again in January in St. Anton, Austria. In two more world-class competitions without a full ramp-up and less than a year since her last operation, she placed sixth downhill and fourth in the Super G, just missing the podium. Quote, I'm skiing without thinking about my knee, which I haven't done since 2013. I'm stronger than I was. It's better than non-existent cartilage, unquote. Should Vaughn return to even near her peak form, which seems more likely week after week, she would become the oldest woman to win a World Cup race. On the men's side, Johan Clary of France won silver in the downhill at the 2022 Beijing Olympics at age 41 and made a World Cup podium at age 42. So far, no one who covers or documents the sport can find another example of a woman racing at age 40 or older. NBC Sports reported that Vaughn was the first woman in her 40s to score World Cup standing points, which she did every time she finished in the top 30. Quote, I have to be patient. I know what I'm capable of. I'm really close, unquote. The prize, compete in the Winter Olympics in Cortellina d'Ampezzo, Italy, next February. Vaughn has won three Olympic medals, including downhill gold in the 2010 Vancouver Games. First, though, she wants to finish this season, finally take that tropical vacation, and then begin preparations for next season. Quote, would I have come back if Cortina weren't there? I don't know. That was one thing that really bothered me when I retired. I wanted to race in Cortina. That was a big goal and a dream of mine, unquote. Competing in Cortina would mark her fifth Olympic Games. She already holds the record for most World Cup wins there, with six in downhill and six in Super G. She recorded her first podium finish there in the year 2004, notched her first World Cup title there downhill in 2008, and broke the all-time wins record there in 2015 and broke the all-time downhill wins record there in 2016. Quote, I have a different connection with every mountain, if that makes sense. I understood Cortina very well. I knew the line that I needed to take and knew where the fall line was, knew how to ski. It was a meaningful place for me to begin with, would be a great place to close the loop, unquote. Should that happen with Vaughn officially ending her career, this time for good, at the place where she has accomplished so much, perhaps there could be a Lindsey Vaughn surgery, like the Tommy John procedure in baseball. Quote, I don't know if you'll see that in sports, because I feel like most people, when their knee gets that bad, they would quit anyway. It's a good option for many, many athletes who are retiring or have already retired. We all view knee replacement as a scary thing that happens when you get old and can't walk anymore. But you're able to bounce back faster and recover easier, unquote. She still confronts hundreds of outdated takes. She wants her comeback to inspire paradigm change, too. Quote, as athletes, we adapt and we figure out how to manage pain. But there comes a point when you don't have to live that way anymore. We have technology to fix things that we thought were unfixable. That perspective of competing at older ages needs to change, unquote. Sports Illustrated then states that some of the reaction to your comeback is wild. Lindsey Vaughn replies, quote, been a little frustrating because that's a close-minded way to think. This is 2025. A lot of things have changed. The conversation is not in the same universe as it was 25 years ago. I don't put any weight behind those comments from competitors who retired a long time ago, and I actually feel sorry for them. They would have benefited from these procedures. I do hope that this opens people's eyes to what is possible. I already have skiers calling me and asking about their knees and hips, unquote. Lindsey Vaughn's mother, Lindy Crone Lund, died in the year 2022, 1 year after being diagnosed with ALS. Lund suffered a stroke while giving birth to Lindsey, which partially paralyzed her left leg. Vaughn watched her mother struggle and fight for the remainder of her life. She begins to cry, softly at first and then a little louder. Quote, no, it's a beautiful thing. I think about it every day. Some idiot online said, I hope Lindsey has a lot of guardian angels because what she's doing is crazy. And unfortunately, I do. She'd be proud of me. I reread her journals when she passed away, and every time I had a race, she was up at 3 a.m. watching, and in her journal she would write the date, the time, and the place I got. I actually feel very protected in a weird way because I know she's looking out for me, and that gives me strength. Unquote. And again, that Sports Illustrated feature is entitled Lindsey Vaughn. 5 years after retiring from competition, the 40-year-old skiing stalwart has made a rapid, pain-free comeback with one clear goal in mind, to race at the 2026 Winter Olympics. Written by Sports Illustrated writer Greg Bishop. And from Olympic skiing news, let's turn now to some basketball news. From this month's scorecard section, the headline reads, Striking Distance. Does the NBA need to curtail the influence of the three-point shot? And this feature, written by Sports Illustrated writer Chris Mannix. In early December, An NBA video circulating online quickly went viral. The clip, a two-minute stretch of the fourth quarter of a nationally televised game between the LA Lakers and the Phoenix Suns, was basketball at its worst. 9 possessions, 9 three-point attempts, 0 shots made. Why don't you watch the NBA anymore? Read one caption. This is why. Fans are watching, of course. The league's Christmas Day slate averaged 5.25 million viewers. For the Lakers' win over the Warriors, a renewal of a long-standing rivalry between LeBron James and Steph Curry, the number was nearly 8 million. A January 8th showdown between Oklahoma City and Cleveland, not exactly traditional basketball hotbeds, averaged 1.87 million viewers, up 20% from a comparable window last season. And the NBA did just close a new media rights deal that will bring in $76 billion in over the next 11 seasons. But still, there are concerns that the game is not growing. I think there are times when you watch the game and it looks beautiful, says Milwaukee Bucks coach Doc Rivers. And then there's times where you watch the game and it looks awful, unquote. Former players bellyache that games have become glorified three-point contests. Indeed, three-point attempts have increased to never-before-seen levels. Boston is on pace to shatter the record for attempts per game this season, while five teams could finish with at least 40 attempts per game. In the 2004-2005 season, Phoenix led the NBA in three-point rate, with 28.9% of its shots coming from behind the arc. This season, Denver ranks at the bottom of the league, with nearly 35% of its attempts coming from three-point range. For the basketball purists out there, says Denver Nuggets coach Michael Malone, I'm sure that it's not their ideal style of play, unquote. The NBA pushes back that the proliferation of three-point attempts is a problem, arguing that talk of skyrocketing threes is overstated. Attempts are up, but only slightly from the last three seasons. The bump in threes have come at the expense of mid-range jump shots, which have ticked down. There's still a steady dose of shots taken at the rim. I would not reduce it to a so-called three-point shooting issue, said NBA Commissioner Adam Silver. I think that we look more holistically at the skill level on the floor, the diversity of offense, the fan reception to the game, all of the above, unquote. Around the league, the issue isn't necessarily the three-point shot. It's how those shots are created, says Pistons coach J.B. Bickerstaff. No one suggests that the Celtics, with an offense built around ball movement, are hurting the game. Penetrating, kicking, swinging, these types of things, that's pretty much basketball, says Bickerstaff. The problem is the teams that don't create off-ball movement and use analytics to justify a higher volume of threes. Sometimes I think that you see a lot of just individual one-on-one off the bounce, says Bickerstaff. The ball doesn't move. Everybody stands and watches, unquote. Adds Rivers, quote, there's teams that only jack shots up and don't play defense. I don't want to watch them, unquote. However it is framed, there is a problem. Offenses, Silver admitted, can look sort of cookie cutter. What we're hearing from fans, and that's something that we're paying a lot of attention to, is that they want more diversity and style on the floor, unquote, said Silver. Solutions, though, are not so obvious. Addressing a group of reporters recently, Silver sought some crowdsourcing. Quote, I look forward to reading and listening to all of your views about what changes we should be making, unquote, he added. Well, Adam, since you asked, first, enforce current rules. Coaches agree there are rules on the books that, if enforced, will bring the game closer to the rim. Defensive 3 seconds, for example. Rules state that any defenders in the paint, quote, must be actively guarding an opponent within 3 seconds, unquote, a rule that is often not actively enforced. Seeing an extra defender in the paint can discourage offensive players from driving. Seeing a clear lane can have the opposite effect. Having a help defender farther away would reduce the number of drive and kicks. Quote, that's probably at least 2 or 3 more times per game where guys are going to the rim instead of shooting threes, unquote, says a veteran assistant coach. There are other rules that are being largely ignored. Referees can be more diligent about calling illegal screens, which often spring 3-point shooters. They can call more traveling when a player switches his pivot foot coming off of those screens. We don't need sweeping changes, says the assistant, just enforce the rules that we already have, unquote. Another suggestion, bring back hand checking. In the year 2004, the NBA, desperate to juice offenses, cracked down on hand and forearm checking, specifically on the perimeter, where players had been allowed to maintain contact with opposing ball handlers. The result was an immediate spike in scoring that launched a new offense-oriented era. Time to turn back the clock. Allowing hand checking and more physicality beyond the 3-point line in general will push the game back inside the arc. It won't lead to a return to the days of two-figure scoring. 3-point shooters in 2025 are far more skilled than those in, say, the year 1995. But it will level the playing field and perhaps encourage more diverse play calling. I do miss the days of a low post presence, says Bickerstaff. A guy who you throw the ball to, you force a double team, and how they rotate, and then you get your threes. To me, that's kind of the Patrick Ewing's, the Hakeem Olajuwon's offense that I grew up watching, unquote. Another feature, a hard cap on made threes. Capping the number of made three-pointers, call it 15 per game, would force teams to be more judicious with their attempts. Play inside the line early to preserve threes late. It's a bit complicated, and the NBA, which has caused plenty of confusion with the standings of its in-season tournament, is loath to introduce anything that creates even more. But if you want to reduce the number of three-pointers, limit the number of makes that count. Yet another possible change to make, expand the 3-point line. In 1994, in an early attempt to increase scoring, the league moved the 3-point line in 21 inches. The game, then NBA Vice President Rod Thorne said, was trending towards becoming a quote-unquote grappling match. The move backfired. While three-point attempts went up, scoring did not meaningfully increase, leading the league to return the 3-point line to its original distance in 1997. Would moving it back make a difference? The shortened three-point line didn't stick partially because with less distance to travel to get to three-point shooters, defenders were able to clog the paint. More distance between the three-point line and the basket would theoretically create more room to operate while making the three-point shot more difficult. For some long-range specialists like Curry and Trae Young, it won't matter. For others, it might. And again, that short feature from Sports Illustrated scorecard section entitled Striking Distance. Does the NBA need to curtail the influence of the three-point shot? Written by Sports Illustrated writer Chris Mannix. And from basketball, let's turn to some football news. Here's a feature from Sports Illustrated's website. Headline reads, Signing Justin Fields is a sensible move for the Jets. After the tumultuous Aaron Rodgers era, New York has made a clear, decisive, and sober decision with a high upside player on a low-cost deal. And this feature written by Sports Illustrated writer Connor Orr. I understand how difficult it might be to accept the fact that the New York Jets have made a clear, decisive, and sober decision at the quarterback position. Free of long-term financial strain, big-picture questions, or calamitous side effects. But that is absolutely the case. To kick off their common sense era, the team agreed to a 2-year deal with Justin Fields worth no more than $40 million and only $30 million of the contract guaranteed. Fields was more than capable through 6 games last season as the Pittsburgh Steelers starter when he was replaced by Russell Wilson, a decision that was curious in and of itself and, if I had to guess, was not made unanimously by every single stakeholder in that offense. At a granular level, he possesses an athleticism that can survive a muddy pocket, which is something none of his recent predecessors in New York, Aaron Rodgers and Zach Wilson, could do. By virtue of this alone, he was the correct choice for a team that has struggled to keep a healthy offensive line in front of its quarterbacks and struggled even more to maintain relevance once the front five took on a kind of painful anonymity. Fields also played with Garrett Wilson at Ohio State, which, while likely not one of the top 100 reasons that the Jets signed him, is a nice nod to an ascending player who has dealt with the insertion of a mercurial quarterback who struggles to adapt. Bringing in his college teammate likely stymies any early rumblings of dissent. And though no one seems to be talking about it, I have found Fields to have gotten better each and every time a game has been placed on his shoulders. So much so that in January of 2024, I argued for the Chicago Bears to keep him alongside Caleb Williams. Though the comparison between someone like him and forever reclamation projects like Baker Mayfield and Sam Darnold isn't totally the same, out of every quarterback on the market this offseason, Fields' upside is the greatest, and he has the widest breadth of scheme versatility. The fact that the Jets got him at a largely non-committal price is the stunning conclusion to the early free agency period. But beyond all this, it says a great deal that the Jets had a plan and executed it. Recovery from the absolute hilarity of the Aaron Rodgers era, less about Rodgers himself and more about an unrestrained owner making a series of haphazard dart throws to evade embarrassment, which further plunged the franchise into a cement mixer of its own making, is going to take many baby steps. The first and most important one was not being batted around in the wind during an off-season unlike any other, where the demand for veteran quarterbacks far exceeds the pool and where some teams, such as the Los Angeles Rams, are hoarding capable starters. During the heat of the Rodgers negotiations 2 years ago, the Jets were essentially competing against themselves for a player that no one else was sure that they wanted. This season offered a similar minefield. Fields seemed to be a backup plan in Pittsburgh, and with Darnold unlikely to consider the New York area code ever again, the Jets were one misstep away from where the New York Giants seemed to be, aggressively talking themselves into thinking that they can be the team to finally unravel the mystery of late career Russell Wilson. To be clear, this is no guarantee of success. Rather, it's simply an indicator of newfound competence, which was absolutely necessary as Woody Johnson takes a step backward into the penalty box of optics. Free agency is largely settled weeks and months before the legality of these negotiations are blessed by the NFL, and when the gun goes off, one can see which teams have laid the groundwork versus those that are simply being taken out with the tide. It's hard enough right now to get any quarterback, but even more difficult to get one who could still get materially better at his job and isn't making a salary commensurate with any of the top 20 highest paid players at the position. One who could pacify a fan base that finished the year with a new definition of bewilderment. Calm players who felt the familiar tug of directionlessness and ultimately aid the replication of the roster in winning some games. We are a long, long way from forgiveness, from feeling the hangover coming to an end, or even talking oneself into believing again. But the course of this past Monday didn't make those in Florium Park sick to their stomachs. That is an overwhelming win. And again, that feature is entitled, Signing Justin Fields is a Sensible Move for the Jets, written by Sports Illustrated writer Connor Orr. And from NFL news, let's turn now to some college basketball news. Headline reads, Indiana coach search. Chris Collins has done what many thought was impossible at Northwestern. Northwestern had never made the NCAA tournament until Chris Collins arrived as the coach. What might Collins do with the resources that Indiana has at its disposal? And this feature written by Sports Illustrated writer Todd Golden. Dateline, Bloomington, Indiana. For most of its history, Northwestern men's basketball has been an afterthought, or worse. In 116 seasons in the Big Ten, Northwestern has just 31 finishes of 500 or better. Of those, 27 of them came before 1967. By comparison, Northwestern has had 15 seasons in the same period where it won 2 Big Ten games or less. Northwestern struggled against much larger Big Ten peers who don't set the same academic standards for their athletes as Northwestern. Once the losing mounted over the decades, a winning tradition could not be sold either. Northwestern was long famous for being the only power conference school not to make the NCAA tournament, and it was thought to be something of a coaching graveyard. One man changed that, Chris Collins. When Collins arrived at Northwestern after being an assistant under Mike Krzyzewski at Duke in 2013, Northwestern had improved under previous coach Bill Carmody, but hadn't broken through as a Big Ten winner. Collins changed that. His 2017 team went 10 wins, 8 losses in the Big Ten, and finally broke the NCAA tournament drought. His teams went 12 wins, 8 losses in the Big Ten in 2023 and 2024. Collins has done what was thought to be impossible. He has made Northwestern relevant in basketball. What could he do with resources and commitment that Indiana has? Much of the attraction was rather obvious. Collins has had 5 winning seasons in Northwestern. He has matched Carmody in that department, but under Collins, the Wildcats of Northwestern have been better in the Big Ten than Carmody's teams were. It isn't just that Collins wins, it's how he wins. His teams are extremely well built. In recent seasons, he has had players like Boo Bowie, Ty Berry, and Nick Martinelli with specific roles where they excelled. Northwestern teams are rarely caught unprepared, and they're hard to break down because role players are committed to being just that. An example is center Matthew Nicholson, who has never been called upon to be a scorer, but who sets screens and does dirty work so others can be productive. Collins is very good at getting players to buy in and in the transfer portal era. Most of his important players have not hit the escape hatch to find greener pastures. Collins' teams are rarely up-tempo and very regularly near the bottom of Division I in tempo, but they are efficient. Northwestern hasn't been out of KenPom's top 100 in offense efficiency in the last 3 seasons. It has only been out of the top 100 in defensive efficiency twice during Collins' tenure. What are the drawbacks with Collins? Northwestern recruits from a completely different starting point than Indiana does. With rare exception, Northwestern is not going to be rubbing shoulders with the Blue Blood programs vying for 5-star talent. Certainly, Collins did so when he was an assistant at Duke, but that was over a decade ago. How Collins would do in today's high-end recruiting environment would be justly scrutinized. While Collins has been successful at Northwestern, it's a comparative level of success. When stacked against coaches who have coached their teams to the Final Four, how can Collins be compared? It's hard to know how good he is as a coach when he's being graded on an institutional curve. Then again, Bob Knight turned out to be a wildly successful choice after coaching at Army, another program that can't just recruit anyone. It probably shouldn't be forgotten that Collins is enjoying a renaissance period at Northwestern. He had 5 straight losing seasons from 2017 through 2022 before getting back to winning ways. Whether the losing was related to Collins or the institutional breaks is, once again, hard to quantify. Northwestern is a private university, so specific contract numbers are not available. But Collins signed an extension in 2023 that keeps him at Northwestern until 2028. Collins has been at Northwestern for so long that he might seem older than he really is. Collins turns 51 in April, so there is plenty of time for him to coach and be successful. Does Collins have an itch to coach at a school like Indiana? Only he knows. It might be hard to leave the Wildcats. In more of a modest way, it's not unlike Scott Drew at Baylor in the sense that he has built his own empire at Northwestern. He would certainly have more job security on hand than in Bloomington. Then again, would Collins think Northwestern is maxed out in what it can accomplish in the Big Ten? If he did think that, maybe Indiana would be a worthy challenge for him. What Indiana would get in return is a smart coach who runs a clean program and has proven that he can find a way to win regardless of the restrictions placed on him. And again, that Sports Illustrated feature is entitled Indiana Coach Search. Chris Collins has done what many thought was impossible at Northwestern, written by Sports Illustrated writer Todd Golden. Let's turn now to some baseball news. This next feature is headlined, Dodgers roll out their three quote-unquote unbelievable new aces. This feature, written by Bob Nightingale of USA Today, Dateline Phoenix. It was the Los Angeles Dodgers pitching version of Charlie's Angels across three different fields in front of frenzied fans one morning and early afternoon last week, charming the coaching staff and front office with visions of October already in the air. It was Shohei Ohtani at 10:30 in the morning, pitching his fourth bullpen session since joining the Dodgers for the 2024 season, showing why optimism is rampant in camp that he'll be dominating on the mound in May. He looks like he could be ready by opening day instead of 2 months into the season the way he has thrown. Has he surprised the Dodgers? Quote, yes, given who the player is and who the person is, manager Dave Roberts said, but there's still a process that we are going through. He just understands that we've got a long season to go, so he's sort of bought into whatever we need from him. But very surprised how quick it's gone, and seeing this is great, unquote. Next up was 23-year-old Japanese sensation Roki Sasaki. He was supposed to throw two innings, but wound up going three innings, throwing 30 pitches against four Chicago White Sox minor league players. He threw 102 miles per hour in Japan, but his velocity was in the mid-90s, giving up a home run to prized catching prospect Kyle Teal on his second pitch and generating four swing and misses. He's been a star since he was 16 years old, Dave Roberts said, so he probably hasn't got hit a lot. But some of these guys that I've seen that have been really good pitchers, they get hit in the mouth and respond back. So he doesn't run away from the competition. That's part of his pedigree, unquote. On the big stage at 1:05 p.m. was two-time Cy Young winner Blake Snell making his Dodgers debut facing the Seattle Mariners. He threw plenty of strikes, 20 in 30 pitches, but lasted just one inning when he was scheduled to go two. He had two swing and misses, each against All-Star center fielder Julio Rodriguez in his lone strikeout. It was an embarrassment of riches, with Snell disappointed he wasn't on hand to check out Ohtani and Sasaki. It's a lot of talent. Sad that I couldn't watch, Snell said, but I had to get ready. But the talent here is pretty, pretty amazing, and I am excited to be here, unquote. No one is predicting that Sasaki is going to go out and win the Cy Young Award in his rookie season, but you can't find anyone who doesn't see future stardom. I thought Roki was good, said manager Dave Roberts, who sat in a golf cart with special assistant Farhan Zaidi watching Sasaki and then driving away with president of baseball operations Andrew Friedman and GM Brandon Gomez riding in the back. Quote, velocity looked good. I thought there's a lot of chase with his split mixed in with some breaking balls, unquote. The tentative plan is for Yoshinobu Yamamoto to pitch Game 1 in Tokyo on March 18th against the Chicago Cubs, Sasaki to pitch the second game on March 19th, and then for Snell to pitch the home opener on March 27th against Cy Young winner Tarik Skubal and the Detroit Tigers. Snell, who missed all but the final week of spring training last season after signing on March 28th with the San Francisco Giants, says that he'll be ready and pleased with his fastball command is already far ahead of schedule. And again, that short feature entitled Dodgers Roll Out Their Three Quote-Unquote Unbelievable New Aces, written by Bob Nightingale of USA Today. And that's all the time that we have for this reading of Sports Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Sports Illustrated. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.